I feel like I just fell out of the sky and landed here, and everybody's looking at me and say something. So, I made some notes for myself because I have a little bit of a subtle aspect. But I want to say again that I'm really honored to be here, and it's very different than Hokoji. Hokoji's like a little flower just starting to bloom again. It's new group and trying to start something over again. But it's kind of like that, this practice. And when I come here, I see some familiar faces and some new faces. And but here, there's a little different style of practice. It's more with the residential aspect and having the longer time or continuity of practice, I think. Hokoji kind of weaves in and out of, depending who's there, what we can do. But it has a nice new, renewed start. And I think also this, again, this type of gathering is rather unique. And it's unique because, as it is stated, you know, it's difficult to acquire a human life if you read those broader texts. They emphasize how difficult it is to get to this place, and not only to have a human life, but to have encountered the Dharma. And also we have encountered each other and are able to gather this in this way, not just this week, but certainly for now, it's just this moment. And be able to encourage each other and share our stories about this sort of mysterious undertaking, mysterious practice. So I think we should all be thankful and respectful of each other in that context particularly. And it's that, in part, what we take refuge in is these three things: the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, this three Buddha bodies. You know, as it is difficult to come in contact with this kind of information and practice way of being, it's, in one sense, that's why we take refuge in the Sangha, because it's people that we can discuss these ideas, these insights, awakening. And in the everyday world, shall we say, if you bring it up, it might not be received so well.
To put it mildly.
And there's a kind of progression of views. Hui Ning talks about this body, this consciousness, being temporal. And so we take refuge in the the Buddha bodies, the Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Dharmakaya. But we tend to have this, what I'm going to say is, you have to be careful not to hear that or interpret that as from an egocentric point of view. Because though we take refuge in it, it's actually like it's not us reaching across to the other shore. It's the other shore is reaching across already. It's already the other shore, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It's like we use our senses to and body and mind to try and acquire this state, usually when we start, when we become aware of there's something else. And actually, it's more like Buddha nature or awakened mind is using these senses to see itself. So, like when we see each other, we're seeing our own basic nature. So there's, in a way, there's the fulfillment already exists. The fulfillment that you're looking for already exists. And so by searching for it, you miss it. Because then you're looking out. And so this way of sitting still like this, it there's nothing to accomplish. It also, in one way, it creates a kind of gateway through your body and mind that you, but in the sense for me that it when I, for example, when I came in and sat down this today, it's like going from 60 miles an hour to 10 miles an hour almost instantly. And the last 10 miles an hour, you become aware of, as you sit, you become aware of what's there, what's left, so to speak, or what's elemental as your existence. And then we can practice this just sitting, and those things also fall off. And at the same time, whether they fall off or not, if it's not based on an egocentric point of view, then it's none other than this suchness or original nature. I find that the use of an aspiration of some sort is good for that. so that we, it's easy to get a little lost in the pursuit of whatever you all are pursuing. This awakened mind trying to wake up. So we have our, you know, Bodhisattva vow. The vow is the 10 precepts, the 3 pure precepts, and so on. These are reminders of how to harmonize with the true nature. How to take away that last 10%. And at the same time, when you have some insight and awakening into the nature of emptiness, then you can operate in the world like, as I said, the Buddha nature coming through your senses. You have an ego that's necessary to operate in the world, but you recognize that it's recognized as empty in itself. But it's a expedient means for fulfilling the aspiration or vow that you've made, such as saving all sentient beings. Accomplishing the Buddha way. And another aspect too is to just give over to the form or the way that is laid out before you, so that don't have to question it or make a decision about whether it's something you want to do or not. You just do it. I was reading translation of a talk by some former abbot of Eheiji about Genjo Koan, which is fairly brilliant, actually. It's quite brilliant. But the one quote that he made in there was in terms of the Genjo Koan, he quoted a priest from our past that said, "You study it by standing in Shoshu, like you practice understanding Genjo Koan this way." And when I read it, it was like a gong went off, and it reminded me very much of last year when Jerry and I had talked before Sesshin about just enacting the form. The way I interpreted it was to, just what I said, you just let go into that form, you know, and it's like it in and of itself is manifesting the wisdom. So there's practicing that way. You don't need to struggle or to aspire to accomplish something. It's already accomplished. Okay. You just wake up to it. And harmonize with it. We were talking about at Hokoji about that you, somebody was talking about when they are at the Zendo, they are in practicing, it's a certain way, but when they go out into the world, it's, you know, they say, then I miss practice. But the idea is that, for me anyway, there's no break. You, whatever, this is foundational and pared down so you can see it more clearly, but you don't stop practice. And when you, as you sit, things, however it is for you, maybe things come up and you are told to let them be, let there be space around them, let them sit to the side, and don't engage them, but don't push them away either, just let everything be. And it's somewhat the same when you go to your job and something comes up, you can also let there be space and let things settle, let it be. Even in the midst of some, if it's a conflict or something, you can still do that. And the idea, of, I believe, is to get away from practice. I mean, you practice and practice and practice until it becomes second nature, and that it becomes a way of life, a way of constant way of being. Not like, not sitting around like this forever, but when you get up and move around, you don't shift your mind. You, in the sense that you still address whatever comes in its different conditions, and therefore it's, but the way you respond is still holding this steadfast mind. And sometimes we slip and I have to come back, but that's the same thing we're doing here.
Well, there was a gong that went off in my head during something that you said. And I'm hoping that later I can remember what it was. But, that's all.
I didn't hear it.
Oh, it was in my head.
Thank you, Ian, for coming back. You know, just recalling, this is the third session that I've been fortunate enough to join in with you. I know it's a long way from Taos. I thought that I would maybe get back to some basics here, since we're starting. This is our first talk. And forgive me if I'm bringing up something that may be the ABCs, but sometimes it's good to look at that again. And you started by identifying the Dharma, the Sangha, and the Buddha. So it would help me if you could refresh me a little bit on those three. As I move into this session briefly. And then perhaps how they converge, or my sense is they might be looking at the same thing from different angles.
Well, when we would say, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, it always sounded so kind of glorious. And I take refuge in the Sangha. It's like, oh, a little disappointing because all the troubles amongst people that we would have, personalities. And, but I've really come to appreciate the Sangha more and more. But I, you know, for me, I tended to be more isolated or something. You know, I didn't need a big group of people to be practice or be happy. But as an example, the Sangha, it's hard to put into words. This is a manifestation of Buddha mind, Buddha mind, suchness, whatever words we can really put to it. In fact, I mean, if you look into the definitions of them, they're different, like different realms almost, and, you know, only a Buddha can see certain things, they say. But with your eye that sees energy, maybe you can see it that way. Or with your heart, you can feel it. So, particularly with the Sangha, sometimes it can be a little bit of a mess, maybe, but it's a manifestation of this mind appearing as individuals.
I heard, I read once that it was a Japanese Roshi, famous, I don't recall the name, and he was being given a tour of Southern California. They were outside the city somewhere looking across a beautiful landscape, and there were stones and rocks, and he just sort of suddenly set forth, oh, look at the Sangha. There were no people there. Mm-hmm. Per se. So my question is this how you view it, in a manifestation of things, or is it more related to human interaction? Sangha.
Well, strictest definition, I suppose, is other people who are practicing the way. But after hanging around Koban for a long time, I started to see the whole world as the Sangha.
People
as sentient beings, all things. We're all practicing together, just whether some aren't aware of it or not. It's the translated as the law, like the truth. But it's, I think of it as the wisdom and the teaching, like not just Buddha's words, but the wisdom of things appearing, also the wisdom of the many ancestral words that have come down to support us and can further inform us and encourage, but also in a way like the sun and the moon, you know, how they appear in cycles like that. And the Buddha is kind of beyond comprehension, beyond verbal comprehension. You can understand it, but that's where prajna comes into play. You have to, you know, we can talk about it, or you can intellectualize it, but you can't really see it that way. You have to almost like do this, and have to put some effort into it initially, especially.
Just sitting. practice. Yeah. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Zazen.
Yeah.
That body then is...
Well, you have to break through your conditioned mind to be able to see Buddha.
And the Buddha body is a reference to...
Well, it's, I would say all things arise from Buddha, that kind of Buddha, Buddha body, Buddha mind. This is Buddha mind. Yeah. Whatever it is you're looking for, this is it. But if you have to experience it. Mm-hmm. For a long time, the sort of peak sitting experiences were always like, you think about it later. That was fantastic. It's like seeing some beautiful, perfect thing, and you, of course you want to go back there, and many years and many long sitting days, and it doesn't appear again. But I realize that this is it. This is the same as that. It just merged somehow. I don't know how to describe that. But there's no... I guess you call it no seeking, no more seeking, you know. It's not like being fully accomplished or anything. It's just that this is the thing itself. It's not outside of us. And that's kind of a beginning point, really. In fact, I was reading something before I came, this whole list of, somebody put together a whole list of quotes from all these various masters, from Shakyamuni Buddha through, you know, the year 1000, and it's all, they're all saying the same thing. It's about from that point, when you don't keep looking outside yourself, you actually stop and turn your light within, is what they call it, the light from the center. And various people said it in various ways, but like Hongzhi called it the backward step. You step back and stop looking outside as though it's outside. It's a kind of technique in a way. Follow it. And follow it back.
I also like to get back to something else you mentioned. This is shore, this notion of the other shore.
Yeah.
I was very interested in hearing a little more about that. Just you went like this with your hand shore, and I thought you said the shore was going to come to us or comes to one, but you said we're already there. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah. Well, there's the notion of the other shore, that we're in suffering, and Buddha's teachings, Buddha's way is going to take you to the other shore. So, the shores merge, I guess you could say. That's what I was expressing, that you don't keep looking outside yourself to start with. And you wake up to Buddha mind, it's already going on. You just can't. If you don't see it, it's because there's some cloth in front of your eyes and you whip it away and it's there. It's not something you create, or it's almost like you have to uncreate your belief system in a way to let it appear, you know, catch a glimpse of it or not. But with that, you, nothing changes, you know, you just keep going. My friends, Tibetan practitioners, American people, Tibetan tradition, they used to come sit with us in New Mexico, and I've probably told some of you this before, but they hadn't seen him in about 15 years or so. And now when I was sitting, it was like, instead of like, you know, trying to reach something, I was just like, it felt very satisfied to sit, like coming home or something. And so they, after this 15-year break, they came to visit, come in the door, and first thing looks at me and says, so how's sitting now? And I said, well, now when I sit, it's like, ah. And they looked at each other. Ah, seed syllable of emptiness. And then off, you know, down the dialogue.
What was the phrase? What did they say?
The seed syllable of emptiness. Ah, ah. Uh-huh.
I also had a thought along what John asked, along the lines of what John asked about, and specifically about the term refuge. We say we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and that's always I've always been curious about. How that is meant, yeah, how is it taking refuge? Does that mean that we use those things as a house and you build this house over yourself as protection? But refuge can mean a lot of things, and it could also mean nourishment, maybe. But does it mean not taking refuge in things that are more transient, and instead to take refuge in these other things? It seems like, does it mean to depend on them, to lean on them? It's always been a little bit confusing to me what the meaning of this taking refuge in these things means.
You should read the Platform Sutra, because he will explain it as well. But sort of like the question of where do you go when you die? What happens? It's that kind of refuge. And beyond your physical body and your consciousness, and you recognize the empty nature of things, and you take refuge in that. So it's not physical.
Is there another word for refuge? And that's just an English word for something that's been translated. So what else might it be translated as? Or maybe other people might have an idea for that.
I don't know another word, but
too bad Michael left.
platform? I wonder, well,
oh.
Because I wonder, because if it's, see, there, I feel like there's kind of, there's emotional leaning and dependence, refuge, you know, something that makes you feel safe and comfortable, right?
But that seems like it's more superficial than what's meant here.
Mm-hmm.
And you seem to be pointing at something more metaphysical.
Mm-hmm.
And platform.
Mm-hmm. Platform Sutra has to do with the name of the sutra, not the, but it's one of the reasons it's called the Platform Sutra is he was speaking on the platform, the ordination platform. So part of that is taking refuge. So there is a correlation, I suppose, but or a relationship. Many people here have taken refuge, so you can you can ask them. But it's, to me, you know, when I was first took refuge with Colvin, I wasn't something I thought about, or it was part of the ceremony, was taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And that's what I was saying, that, you know, for a long time, the Sangha, for example, it was like, oh my God, do I really have to take refuge in them? What does that mean? But you become, you have to feel it. You have to feel the despite the issues, say, in the Sangha, for example, amongst personalities, you feel the support and, like, being able to talk about these things together and practice like this. I mean, that's a kind of refuge that you can understand directly from the word. This kind of environment and space is a refuge in the context of being able to come down from all the way, the front that you have to put out to be in day-to-day life. You come here and you can let go of all that. So it's a kind of harbor in that sense. But more so, it's those three things are one thing, actually, and it's like it's your true body. It's the body that we all inhabit. If you don't look at it from an egocentric point of view, because it's really obvious that we identify with this body and its feelings and emotions and its needs, and yet it is arising from something that is far vaster and infinite, in fact. And we recognize that and we say, ah, this is temporary. I acknowledge this other thing as being the truth. And being true, when you experience it, there's no doubt. And you take refuge, only because there's no other choice. It's not like you make a choice to take refuge. It just is the way it is. All these things are coming from enlightened mind, this information. It's not like somebody made up a plan for a way to behave and said, let's have these 10 prohibitory precepts. Those are, when you wake up to this original mind, it's all that stuff is in place. There's no question about it. You don't have to pick and choose, in other words. They're just like different colors of the same thing. So if you were to wake up to it and reject it, then you wouldn't be taking refuge, I guess. But otherwise, it's pretty hard not to. I don't know. I just thought of that. It's a possibility, then, for the sake of argument. I don't think so.
Maybe reject is too strong a word. Maybe
doubt.
Accept.
Yeah.